Thank you all. Thanks for having me with you here this morning. I'd say it's really encouraging to be here and seeing such a very encouraging mix of ages and backgrounds and to be able to share with some of you over the last 2 days now. It seems longer. 2 days of the CMS weekend. It's a real pleasure for me, and thank you for having me. I'd like to begin this morning by asking two questions which are related to each other. The first one is, what is your purpose in life? There's a number of answers you could give to that question. For example, the purpose of life is to be happy, quote the Dalai Lama. The purpose of life is not to be happy, Ralph Waldo Emerson. The purpose of life is not to be happy, it's to be useful, it's to be honourable, to be compassionate, to have made some difference that you have lived and lived well. For some, it's experience, Eleanor Roosevelt. The purpose of life is to live it, to taste experience to the utmost, to reach out eagerly and without fear for newer and richer experience. For others, the purpose of life can be to have a good family. It might be to be a good parent. It might be to make money. It might be to be rich or powerful or well-known or many other things. Or as the great modern poet and philosopher Arnold Schwarzenegger put it, for me, life is continuously being hungry. I often wonder what he means by that. But he goes on. He says, the meaning of life is not simply to exist, to survive, but to move ahead, to go up, to achieve, to conquer, said Arnold. So what is the purpose of your life this morning? What's the purpose of our life? It's a really key question. It's a question that lays the groundwork and the foundation for nearly everything else in our lives and our existence. What is the purpose of life? Well, if God does not exist, that question in itself is irrelevant. If God doesn't exist, then you and I have no real purpose. William Craig Lane, the apologist, puts it like this. He says, you are the accidental byproduct of nature. You're a result of matter plus time plus chance. There is no reason for your existence. All you face is death. The same is true of the human race. Mankind is a doomed race in a dying universe. Because the human race will eventually cease to exist, it makes no ultimate difference whether it ever did exist. Mankind is thus no more significant than a swarm of mosquitoes or a barnyard of pigs, for their end is all the same. The same blind cosmic process that coughed them up in the first place will eventually swallow them all again. If God doesn't exist, we don't have a purpose, but God does exist. God is real. And as we come to his word this morning, we know, and if you are a Christian here this morning, most of us are, you know that you have a purpose. What is that purpose? Theologians in the past have debated that question. One way of putting that question is, what is the chief end of man? Our famous confession, the Westminster Confession, answered that question in the Shorter Catechism by these words. What is the chief end of man? The chief end of man is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. I think it's a wonderful answer. The chief end, the purpose of man in general, of Christians in specific, is to know God. It's to glorify God, to enjoy God forever. Those two things, knowing him, enjoying him, glorifying him. That is the chief end of man. Another way of putting that is simply to say it's to worship. Because I think that's what worship is. When I say, what is worship, many of us will think, well, it's the songs we sing or don't sing, it's the clothes we wear or don't, it's where we meet or we don't meet. We'll think of those terms of corporate worship. We might think of musicians leading us in that corporate worship. And worship is that. But if the definition given in that catechism is correct, and it is, worship is far more than that. It's the way we enjoy God day by day. It's the way we know God day by day. And it's the way that we glorify God to a world out there, to a world in here. That is what true worship is. So that second question I want to ask you this morning is, what does true worship look like? That's a definition, if you like. What does it look like to both know and enjoy God and to glorify him? It's a very big question. I'm not going to try and answer all of it this morning. But coming to the book of 2 Samuel, and we're in chapter 6. It was read. There are some pew Bibles there if you'd like to follow. I'll read it. You don't need to, or your iPhone or iPad or whatever. But we'll see there in this chapter, it's an unusual chapter, but it's got quite a lot to say about what true worship is. So let's look at it together now. What is true worship? It's this. Well, the chapter opens with David as king over all Israel. If you've had the opportunity to read through these books before, or maybe you've joined it over the weekend as we've cherry-picked bits of them, you'll know that for 15 years, David patiently waited. He was the boy that was anointed by the prophet Samuel. The boy taken from being a shepherd, taken from out the back of Wolpiup, looking after the sheep, brought in to the centers of power. And now, this man after God's own heart is on the throne of Israel. And David decides it's time to bring the Ark of the Covenant back to the center of the limelight in Jerusalem. What's the Ark of the Covenant? I said on Friday night, if you've seen Indiana Jones, you've got a very good idea of what the Ark of the Covenant looks like. It's that golden box in the Raiders of the Lost Ark, 4 feet long, 2 feet wide, 2 feet high. It's the place, it symbolizes God's presence with his people. And David says, I want that back in Jerusalem. And he organizes 30,000 people to go with him. That was one heck of an entourage. But he organizes it to go back. And what happens next, though, is shocking. So I want to imagine that you're there. You're watching this scene. You're part of that entourage. You're going back. The ark is being carried on the cart. And everyone around it says there's singing. There's all sorts of musical instruments and tambourines. And the commentator, Dale Ralph Davis, puts it like this. He says, it was fun. It was loud. It was religious. There was dancing and singing and lyres and cymbals and tambourines. Kiriath Jearim was rocking, he says. The ark was traveling on a new cart pulled by oxen while Ahio and Uzzah served as attendants. Strange thing happened near the threshing floor of Nacon. It took a moment for everyone to realize it. The dancing stopped. The music stopped. All eyes turned to Uzzah, on the ground, writhing, twitching, then still. Someone called 000. The party was over. Verse 7, the Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore God struck him down, and he died there beside the ark of God. That's not just a story. Just a fairy tale, that happened. The same God that we gather together to worship, the same God of whom we ask the question, what does true worship look like, did this. What do you think of that? So, the ark's traveling along, it's on the cart, and Uzzah and Ahio are walking along. You can picture what this would look like. The cart wobbles, the ark starts to topple, and Uzzah thinks, no, don't want to see that, and he reaches out and he steadies the ark, and boom! God strikes him dead. Where's the justice in that? Richard Dawkins, maybe he's right. He wrote this. He says that the Christian God is, here we go with this, misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent, bully. And you thought Hebrew was hard to pronounce. Some people will say that, well, this is the nasty Old Testament God. It's not the nice New Testament God we see in Jesus. Jesus would never do something like this. But when we consider what true worship looks like, and we consider this moment, this snapshot from the book of 2 Samuel, before we get too up on our high horses about this, we need to ask the question, well, was Uzzah really an innocent victim of an arbitrary God? Was he? Well, you see, God had long ago given very specific instructions about the Ark of the Covenant, which symbolized his presence with his people. You might remember them. Basically, they were no touch, no look, and no cart. The Ark was to be carried by poles, it says in the book of Numbers, chapter 4. God gives very detailed instructions. And his, at the end, he says, is to be carried by poles, lest they die. And God clearly didn't want them to die, or he wouldn't give them the warning, would he? As I said, I had over 20 years in the army. Many of days of my life were spent at range practices, on the live firing ranges, on blank firing ranges as well. But at the end of every range, as an officer, I'd gather the troops together. They'd open up their webbing and their pouches, and they'd make a declaration that they had no ammunition or range produce in their possession. At the end of that, I would give them this morning, I would say. It is my duty to inform you that it is an offence, both civil and military, to remove ammunition or range produce from a live-firing range, this being such a range. If you have any in your possession now, it is your duty to declare it to me now. Pause. Used to say in the brackets in my notes. And if you have any and you declare it now, nothing further will be said. If, however, at a later time, ammunition or range produce is found in your possession, you will be subject to the full extent of civil and military prosecution. You have been warned, I would say. Now, what was the purpose of that warning? Number of reasons, obviously, but the key reason for that warning that I would give hundreds of times was that if they did have ammunition or range produce in their pouches that they were taking away, what would happen is something called contamination of blank ammunition. And that is, and the next exercise, they're out bush, it's a training exercise, they're reaching in for ammunition, they're loading it into their magazines, they're firing, and they point it at someone, and they pull the trigger, bang, bang, boom. That's a live one. And somebody dies. It happens in armies around the world. And the reason that we warn that over and over again, the prime reason is not because we want to be arbitrary, because we want to catch them out and punish them. It's because we don't want that to happen. And this is the words of a God who warns us. And when you read the warnings in Scripture, you can view that as, oh, God is angry at me and he's just wanting to punish me. Or you could actually say, God's warning me in love. He doesn't want this to happen. And this is the case here. David and Uzzah and the worship team at Kiriath Jearim, they should have known better. God had given them the warnings. They knew them. They chose to disregard them, and God's judgment on Uzzah is hardly arbitrary. But how does this story on God's judgment relate to my question, to our question this morning, of what does true worship look like? Let me illustrate with a story. A few years ago, my wife Dana and I were asked to a wedding. It was summer, and after a little while, I went out to get some air and get away from the noise of the wedding. And someone else came out. He was a young man, maybe in his 20s, 30s. He came out and started to talk with me. And he had too much to drink, as sometimes happens at weddings. And he was in the mood for a chat. And he talked away, and he said he was a corporal in the army. I was like, okay, you know. And I didn't get a word in really for the first 5 or 10 minutes. And he was telling me about his service in the army, and he started to say how useless the officers were. He goes, oh, army officers, they're just terrible. Where do they get these guys from? You know, they can't do anything. Corporals, like he was, we do all the work. You know, these army officers, oh, they just take up all the pay and they go around writing in their notebooks and giving orders, and oh, it's disgraceful. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay. And he's talking away, and then he ran out of steam on that one, and he shifted tacks, and he started talking about some of the names which the soldiers in his unit had called their children. And he was going from what he considered to be the sublime to the ridiculous. And he culminated and he said, and can you believe it? This one, oh man, one of the guys in our unit, he called his son, wait for it, Jonty. Oh, he's laughing, you know, he thought it was very funny. Had a few, and then he ran out of steam and he said, oh, sorry, I haven't even asked, what's your name? What do you do? And I said to him, it was actually really funny. I said to him, well, actually, I'm a serving army officer. I'm a captain in the army. And I've got three boys at the time. And there's Ethan, there's Elijah, and there's Jonty. And he went brick red. You can imagine. He apologized and he vanished back inside, and I didn't see him again. Now, why did he make a fool of himself in that situation? He made a fool of himself because he didn't know the one to whom he was relating. He thought he did, but he didn't know. And he presumed that he knew the person he was talking to, but he didn't really know him. And what's very clear from this account in 2 Samuel is that true worship is only possible if you know the one that you are worshiping. It's one of the reasons why this church, and I believe every church, we need to come back to this book, because otherwise we only know God through his revelation that God gives us. That's how we can know God. Yes, we can know this book backwards and not know God, but if we don't know this book, then we can't know God. Not properly. Because if we're going to know the God, we've got to know the one we worship. If we're going to worship him, we've got to know him. And the one that this word, this Bible, the one this chapter in Samuel talks about is one who has heat in his holiness. There's a holiness in God which we are very mistaken if we neglect. We are in danger of thinking that we know the one we worship when we really don't. I often hear patronizing nonsense about God from people who claim to worship him. I hear people who seem to refer to God as their mate, their best buddy. The idea of, yeah, God and me are mates, you know, we'll when I die, you know, we'll go and play nine holes in the sky, or, you know, God's my mate. You know, God's the genie in the bottle. Genie in the lamp. I'm going to rub that lamp and the genie will come out and God will give me what he wants and then I'll put him back in the genie. Other people I meet, and many of these sincere Christians, who think that they can cherry pick what God is like, that they can read through God's word, and as God reveals himself, he says, this is who I am, they can pick the bits that they like and skim over the bits that they don't. It's very dangerous. It's very dangerous, because what you actually do as you do that is you make a design of God who actually is not man being created in God's image, but God being created in man's image, and that's no God. You can try and worship that, but this point from 2 Samuel, as Uzzah found out, is the God that we worship, there is heat in that holiness. In verse 8 of these events, David is angry at God. I think he's wrong to be angry. I think he's wrong to be angry at God. But in verse 9, it says he was afraid. And I think it's right to be afraid. Now, I want to pause there, because some of you will hear immediately, oh, he's saying I need to be terrified of God, that I need to be, you know, prostrate before him when I come. That is not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there is an element of transcendence in God, which we are creatures. He's the creator. We need to remember that in our worship. And if we lose that, we lose the real God. So I'll give you an example. As I said, I love being a dad. And for my own upbringing, I had a very good dad. He loved us. He played with us. He hung out with us. He wrestled with us. He taught us. He stuck around with us. He was a very good dad. But let me tell you that there was an element of, and I believe was appropriate, fear, even to this day, I have of my dad when we did the wrong thing. Now, my brothers and I especially were pretty strong-willed. We knew that if we pushed the boundaries, if we did things that were not right, particularly if we treated our mother in a way that was not acceptable, that there would be a consequence to that. And many times I remember looking at the same dad who I would happily play around with on his knee and joke and play games with, and walk towards him with shaking, trembling, that realizing that I'd done the wrong thing. God's a bit like that. It's appropriate to fear God. It's appropriate to come to God with a sense of his transcendence and his power. Jesus makes it very clear to us. He says in Luke chapter 5, verse 5, he says this, I will show you whom you should fear, he says. Fear him who after the killing of the body has power to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Fear him. So that first question of what is true worship look like, I would say that from this passage, as we look at 2 Samuel chapter 6, true worship knows the one that it is worshipping and is afraid. Secondly, true worship not only knows the one it worships and is afraid, true worship is filled with joy. I picture again that scene as the ark is coming back into Jerusalem. David's heard about the blessing on the house of Obed-Edom, and he goes, wow, maybe I can bring that ark back with me in Jerusalem. He's got encouraged by that. He's got the whole gang together. They're coming back, and picture that happening right here, right now. Picture Greg's up the front. He's twirling around like a whirling dervish. There's cymbals and there's tambourines, and that's a bad mental image, let's stop that. But there's this picture of rejoicing and celebration. It's noisy, it's unpredictable, it's confronting, this holy delirium. And you say, but didn't you just say that one of the aspects of true worship is that we know the one we worship and we fear him? And now you're saying that there's also this rejoicing? How do those two go together? Surely you can't be afraid or fear someone and rejoice in their presence. And I'd say, yes, you can. That is actually exactly what the Bible tells us about God is. The text says that true worship, there's fearfulness and there's gladness. There's terror and there's joy. Now, it's a paradox. And if you're not a Christian here this morning, you won't understand it. If you are a Christian, you will know that actually when you sense God's full transcendence and his power, that is also when you experience the deepest joy. I love studying in particular the Great Awakening of the 18th century in America and in the United Kingdom. The amazing outpouring of God's blessing through men like George Whitefield and John Wesley and Jonathan Edwards. And seeing what God did there. Now, as I've read those biographies and I've read those accounts, it's very interesting that you see, almost without exception, that when God's Spirit is poured out and when God's people are stirred, there is an overwhelming sense of God's transcendent holiness. That people are broken down before him. There are many accounts of people in services beginning to weep and to cry and to outpour as they realize who God is and who they are not. They realize the gulf between them and God. And yet, in those very same meetings, there is also an outpouring of joy, of laughter. And the critics of the Great Awakening would go and say, oh, it's all about enthusiasm, they used to call it. It's all about excitement. It's all about drumming up emotion. But when you read what actually happened in those awakenings, the both of them were together. As people saw who God was and who they weren't, and they saw what Jesus Christ had done for them through the cross, it overwhelmingly resulted in celebration and in joy. And when we see God as he really is, when the horizons of the God, on Friday I spoke about the God we put in the box, when that God comes out of the box and the horizons broaden and the transcendence of God is revealed to us, that's when we worship with true joy. Our fear of God, our understanding of God doesn't suppress our joy, it stimulates it. That's the reality of worship. In Psalm 2, verse 11, and maybe David wrote this. If he did, it doesn't say it was David, but I reckon he could have. It says these words, three words. Psalm 2, verse 11, rejoice with, you don't know what that third word is? Trembling. It is joy. Rejoice, joy with trembling. Rejoice with trembling. So true worship, firstly, it knows the God that it claims to worship and is afraid. Secondly, it rejoices in the presence of God. And thirdly, and finally, true worship is done humbly before an audience of one. Now, I want to introduce this final point to you by telling you about an event that happened to Dan and I several years ago. I have your permission to tell this. It was the Queen's birthday public holiday. It was a significant day. It happened also to be Dana's 30th birthday. And I thought, well, take her out for dinner, but before we do, let's run some exercise, run some energy out of the boys for the babysitters. So we took the kids to Jan Juk near Torquay there, and we walked along the headland. It was a grey, cold, freezing winter's day in Geelong. We were all rugged up, we were walking, and we got back to the car, and my two oldest boys, who were probably, I don't know, 4 and 2 at the time, decided that they wanted to go swimming. And Dan is saying, no. And they said, please, Dad, please. And I was like, oh. All right. So we trooped down. If you've been to Jan Juk, you know, some big wooden steps. Down the wooden steps to the beach. And I'm sort of shivering there under the cliff. And the boys are, you know, off go all their clothes, you know what it's like. And these naked little bottoms running out into the waves. And I'm standing thinking, oh, gee, this is a bit... If something happens and they get swept out, it's going to take me a long time to get all my clothes off. And like, I better just be prepared. So I took my shoes off and took my jumper off. And I thought, oh, man, they're getting along. And I better... So I took my trousers off. And then finally, there's no one there. It's winter. And finally... the boys, somehow or other, I got sucked into the fun. And I was out there in the beach, in my undies, running around with these two naked little boys, having a wonderful time, water splashing. And finally, you know, we were freezing cold, we were blue, and everything was, we were having a wonderful time, flushed, but freezing cold, and we trooped back up the stairs, and then we saw Mum. We saw Dana. And it was not a happy Dana. And she said... So, that's why those ladies were laughing when they came up the steps. What would they do? What would they think if they knew that was a curate of the Anglican Church down there? What would they have thought? Our joyful exuberance was gone very quickly, and it was a very quiet ride home. And she was right. She was right. It was inappropriate. I got sucked in, and I had no idea that people were watching up in the steps, and it was embarrassing. Well, if you take that example and you put it into the church context, you start perhaps a little bit to approach what happens in the last bit of this chapter. David has had the party of his life. He's danced before the Lord with all his might, covered in sweat, I imagine. And the text tells us he's wearing a linen ephod. Did some work on research on linen ephod. And I don't know exactly what it was, but apparently it was a sleeveless linen tunic that didn't go much beyond the hips. And maybe our context today, a big set of wire-front undies might be kind of somewhere in that picture, in a modern equivalent. And David is dancing before the Lord wearing this. And he is lost in his wonder of who God is. He's rejoicing. The sweat's pouring off him. He's leading the worshippers as they come dancing and singing with all the tambourines and the cymbals and all the other things that the instruments it mentioned. And as he comes into Jerusalem wearing his priestly underwear. The joy is contagious. He's blessing people. He's handing out gifts of food. And finally, he goes home and he's met by his wife, Michal. Michal, we're told in verse 16, has been watching all these goings on from the window. And it says that she has despised him in her heart. Another commentator, John Hercus, describes the scene like this. He says, "When David came home at last, tired and flushed, still delirious with the truth he'd been singing and dancing all that day, Michal rose from the sofa on which she had been reclining. Her makeup was just right. Not a wisp of untidied hair was out of place, not a crease in her beautiful gown. Her long lashes hung disdainfully over eyes that looked him up and down with a quick, contemptuous glance of scorn. 'Well,' she said slowly, deliberately averting her eyes as if from some distinctly repugnant sight, 'what a spectacle. What a scene the King of Israel made of himself today. It was simply disgusting. Dancing around like that with all the people watching, kicking up your legs in that shameless way. You should have seen the gaping of all the servant girls. It was vulgar.' And she turned her back," he says. Now, we're privy to a far more than just a simple marital spat here. Dana was completely justified in her annoyance of my spectacle on the beach, but this is different. The writer, three times in verses 16, 20, and 23, refers to Michal as daughter of Saul. The writer wants us to know that in these words and in this attitude of heart that we see in Michal, Saul's daughter, we are getting a pointing back to the old regime. What was that old regime? You remember, if you early in 1 Samuel, Saul, head taller than anybody else in all of Israel, handsome to look at, bold, good-looking, the perfect thing that you'd want for a king, but also a man whose heart is very far from the God he claims to worship. Saul's regime was all about appearances. It was all about doing what looks good. And towards the end of his life, Saul consistently wants Samuel to come back, not because he wants God's presence with him again, because he wants everyone to see that, oh, Samuel's with me, it's all okay. Saul is about the outward appearance. David, in 1 Samuel 16, is chosen the famous words of Samuel, where he says, or God says to Samuel, "Man looks at the outward appearance. God looks at the heart." Now, Michal is concerned with dignity, decorum, outward appearances that she thinks a king ought to maintain. David's got an answer for her. Did you hear it? He says, "You know what, Michal? God doesn't give two hoots about what people think of you. He doesn't give two hoots about the way you look. God looks at your heart." That's what he says. He says, verse 21, "I'll celebrate before the Lord, Michal. I'll become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I'll be held in honor. I'll become even more undignified than this," David says. So what is true worship? It's being humiliated in your own eyes, thirdly. It's being not worried about external appearances. It's being worried about what is going on inside. There's no room for pride here. As a chaplain in the army, I did many and have done many formal public services. Before those services, I dressed in the full robes. I've got my medals lined up. Nothing wrong with any of that. The RSM, the regimental sergeant major, give me a look over to make sure everything is right, and then we all process out. It's very regal. It's very dignified. It's done in decorum. And really, honestly, it's done for appearances. There's any number of people in any church, except this one, I'm sure, who are very concerned with services, especially not going too long. Procedures, externals, mechanics, decency and order, but really have no understanding of the joy of the Lord. There are some in my city of Geelong who can go off the emotional chart in rapture when Geelong kicks a winning goal, but can't muster up any more than professional detachment about Jesus Christ. And what is even more shocking is that many of these people seem to believe that cold-hearted, church-going, stoic worship is somehow pleasing to the God they claim to worship. 2 Samuel 6 is clear. God takes no pleasure in cold, formal, distant worship that focuses on externals, whether it's in our public gatherings as a church or whether it's in our private lives. I'm not in any way saying that joyous worship must be singing choruses, by the way. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be singing hymns or that it should never use liturgy or that it should be done in shorts and thongs and sneakers. I'm not saying any of those things. I am saying, though, that it's the attitude of our heart that matters. And that question, then, as you live your life of worship, both in this context, public worship and in private, is who's your audience? Who are you trying to impress? Is it those around you? I think that's really what most of the army formal traditional services do. Dress perfect, robes, medals, but really thinking about what they're thinking. And yet, in my experience as an army chaplain, particularly when I was at Kapuka, some of the times when I think we saw the real true worship were those occasions that were not like that. Some of my best memories of Kapuka is a group of soldiers. I was trying to speak very loudly and then very quietly according to the volume of the range running behind me and the explosions of the ammunition and the ordnance, and looking at their hearts and seeing that, you know, they're sitting around on grass, sitting on their webbing in camouflage uniform, and their eyes opening to the reality of the God that they served, serving those guys and girls and guys communion and seeing them relate in that way. That was true worship, because they didn't care about what was going on. They weren't worried about the person. They were coming close to God, and I think God was pleased. On one particular occasion, and please don't think this is my usual routine, one particular occasion we had a wonderful Sunday at Kapuka. There'd been, I think it was 30 people who had said, yes, we want to follow Jesus. The next morning, Monday morning, was early. It was usually very quiet in the chapel. And I came down and I initially sat on that spot where those people had gathered at the front to be prayed with and for. And as I sat there, I put on some worship music on the chapel sound system and just started to pray and I got carried away with who God was. And I said, it doesn't always happen to me. I wish it did, but it did in this morning. And the tears started to flow and finally, as I realized more of who God was and what he was doing, I stretched out on the floor and I was crying out and tears were falling, and then the door opened of the chapel. It's not meant to happen on Monday morning. And in walked a senior officer and a whole bunch of people on a tour. It was the most. I was mortified. I think he was mortified even more so. But as they came in, and I thought, oh, this is terrible. This is so embarrassing. Oh, I've really given chaplaincy and I've given God a terrible. Oh, and then afterwards, I thought about it and I thought, hang on. My worship is done before an audience of one. Yours is too. What people think of you, how you worship, in terms of a public sense or private sense, that's between you and God. It's the audience of one. If you like to sing hymns or you like to sing choruses or you like to wave your hands around, that's decorum. And we need to maintain, particularly in public worship, we need decorum. But ultimately, what matters is your worship of the audience of one. He's the only one that matters. So let me conclude. What's our purpose in life? It's not to be happy. It's not to be wealthy. It's not to be well thought of by everyone else. Our purpose is to worship God. What does that worship look like? True worship knows the one that it worships. True worship rejoices in with great rejoicing as it sees the one it worships. And true worship arises from the humility of the heart before a God who couldn't give a stuff about outward appearances, but cares very much about the attitudes of our hearts. True worship is about fear, joy, and humility before an audience of one. Let me pray for us. Father God, in our lives of worship, we seek to know you. We seek to enjoy you. We seek to glorify you. Father, very often we don't worship well. But Father, I pray that you would use this text of 2 Samuel. You would use these events that happened so long ago to turn our hearts and our thoughts and our minds back to you. To fill us with who you are, the wonder and grandeur of your name, to help us to tremble in awe before you, but at the same time to rejoice with great and inexpressible joy arising from the fact that you have saved us through Jesus Christ, you have set us free, you have made us your sons and your daughters. And Father, I pray that all of our worship, all of our lives of worship, here in this place and this church, here in the daily existence of our lives outside this place, would be done before you as our audience of one. May you see into our hearts, and may what you see in there bring you joy. And we pray it in the name of the Lord Jesus.